Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, hundreds of marchers gathered in East LA this past Saturday to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Chicano moratorium, when tens of thousands came to protest the disproportionate death toll of Mexican Americans in the Vietnam War. It would be the largest gathering of Mexican American demonstrators up to that point, and a key moment for the Chicano movement in its heyday. But what would begin as a joyous march and rally would turn violent and deadly. We examine the protest's legacy. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Los Angeles journalist Ruben Salazar died 50 years ago Saturday when a sheriff's deputy struck him in the head with a tear gas canister. He died instantly, according to the people who were there that day, August 29, 1970. On that day, more than 20,000 people had gathered in East LA to protest the disproportionate death toll of Mexican Americans in the Vietnam War. The Los Angeles Times has launched a project examining the social, political, and cultural legacy of the National Chicano Moratorium against the Vietnam War. And two of the writers on the project join us now. Gustavo Arellano is a features writer for the LA Times, host of the LA Times' This Is California, The Battle of 187, former publisher and editor of Orange County's alternative weekly, OC Weekly, and the author of the column Ask a Mexican. His books include Ask a Mexican and Taco USA. Welcome to Forum, Gustavo Arellano.
Gracias for having me.
Really appreciate you being here. Also with us, Daniel Hernandez, a reporter covering culture in LA for the LA Times. He's formerly a reporter for the style section of the New York Times, editor of LA Taco, producer and correspondent for Vice News, editor of Vice Mexico, and staff writer at LA Weekly. Welcome to Forum, Daniel Hernandez.
Hi, thank you.
I'm going to start with you, Daniel, if I could. And I'd like to, of course, help everybody know and understand and remember what the Chicano moratorium was. And could you first explain why it was called a moratorium?
Yes. Well, the moratorium term, I guess, came from this idea that activists of the period who were distressed by the disproportionate numbers of casualties that were calculated among Mexican-Americans, Hispanic-Americans, wanted a moratorium, a suspension of the loss of brown lives in the theater of war there in Vietnam. And so for them, it was really pertinent and really important to literally put a stop to these deaths, because during the tumult of the late 1960s and into the 1970s, there was, of course, obviously a lot of different civil rights movements, and this was the one that was really most activating, I think, young Chicanos, young Mexican-Americans across the country. I mean, much of the organizing happened in the Bay Area, Denver, Arizona, Texas, and in Southern California, in East LA.
And so what did people attribute the disproportionate number of deaths to?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that there's actually still a lot of historicizing to be done about that. Mexican Americans, of course, since the earliest conflicts that this country has been involved in, have kind of always been there and available, kind of front and center, and have been involved in the major interventions and wars that the United States has been involved in. And so I think that there is something of a tradition in the Mexican American community. Siblings, relatives of mine have, you know, served in the armed forces, And so there's probably an element of that. But I also think that given that Mexican Americans and Latinos were and have been historically so marginalized by the institutions and by the government or abused by the police, which quickly became another element of struggle of the Chicano moratorium, that there is more of an incentive or people pushing young Mexican Americans to go into the service as opposed to, let's say, higher education.
You know, one of the things that I was so struck by was how joyous everyone describes the Chicano moratorium as being. Can you talk about that? And when did it start to turn?
Yes, well, it really was. There's this very a beloved photograph that still circulates of a couple that had just gotten married that briefly joins the march. There were people, obviously it was Mexican-American led, but there were people of all ethnicities and colors that were present there, including, you know, activist Jewish American lawyers and African Americans in solidarity. And it really was a very familial, joyous sort of event. There had been, according to the accounts, kind of fringe elements, the way that we have today, you know, frankly speaking, in terms of some of the peaceful protests that occur in our cities today, of people who are sort of taunting or trying to confront some of the sheriff's deputies that were sort of monitoring the course of the march. Once it reached the park, there was some kind of trouble at a liquor store about a block away. It's so crazy because I was literally just there this weekend and I saw it's still named the Green Mill Liquor Store. Mm. And police were called there. And then that's where someone threw a bottle, and then the word basically of rioting or of theft kind of arose from there. And then the sheriff's department literally seemed to just sort of raid the park and start attacking indiscriminately with batons and with tear gas. The people who had been gathered there, and then some elements of the people who were being attacked through the tear gas back, through bottles and rocks. And so it kind of all devolved from there.
And of course, Gustavo Arellano, this is the protest that killed Ruben Salazar. This event was where it happened. And that is what your piece reflects on quite a bit, was the police killing of this journalist. Can you remind us who Ruben Salazar is, first of all?
Ruben Salazar is a titan of American journalism in the sense that he literally created a genre from nothing, the Latino beat, covering Latinos as more than just as some people call them zoo pieces, treating Latinos as individuals. So he was a reporter born in Juarez, right across from El Paso, but grew up in El Paso, joined the Los Angeles Times in 1959, one of three Latino reporters at the time, ends up becoming a foreign correspondent, covered California as well. Then in 1969, the owner of the Los Angeles Times, Otis Chandler, calls him back from Mexico City and says, look, we finally realized, hey, there's a lot of Mexican Americans here in Southern California. They're really upset. And you start covering them. And so he covered them for a year as a reporter, but he felt stymied by a career advancement at the Los Angeles Times. So in 1970, he gets a job as a news director for KMX, Canal 34, which is a Univision station now in Southern California. But the Los Angeles Times also offered him a role as a columnist. In other words, he was now going to be able to give his opinions about the day, and especially with Mexican-American movements. His first one, February 6, 1970, was called What is a Chicano and What is it That He Wants? Is a classic immediately of Chicano literature. You read it even today, it's literary lightning.
And can you tell us what happened to him? And I realized when I read the intro, I called what killed Salazar a tear gas canister, but really in later reading other articles in the project, I mean, it was like a torpedo-shaped projectile that was designed to rip through plywood that was shot into the bar where he was, right?
Oh, yeah, it was horrific. So what ended up happening was Ruben's there in his role as a news director for KMX on August 29th, 1970. Things start really to get horrible, frankly. So he ducks into a bar with one of his colleagues, the Silver Dollar Cafe. By all accounts, he's drinking a beer. The LA sheriff's deputies say they get a call that there's a hostage situation inside the Silver Dollar Cafe, even though everyone says there wasn't. So there's an iconic photo taken by Raul Ruiz, a legend in Chicano journalism, that shows an LA sheriff's deputy holding what looks like a little bazooka, but it's his tear gas gun, as a woman's desperately trying to make him stop. He fires this canister, this projectile, really, no more than 20 feet inside the bar. The bar is, the door is open, but there's a curtain as a partition. It goes directly into the bar and immediately kills Ruben. And if you see the picture, though, you know, I'm not a police officer, but I have friends who are in law enforcement. And they say, you know, when you're at a crowd, when you fire a tear gas, you fire it on the ground so it scatters. You don't fire it up. Like, you don't even fire it at face level because of that very reason that it could hurt someone. Well, in this case, it killed someone. They left Ruben's body there for 7 hours until they finally were able to take it out.
And, you know, these facts have left people wondering if, in fact, Ruben Salazar was targeted by sheriff's deputies and police. Can you explain why?
In one of his first columns, he angered the police chief of Los Angeles, Ed Davis, hugely. In fact, to the point where Ed Davis basically put him on an enemies list. At that time already, the FBI has a secret file for Salazar, and they actually got a source within the Los Angeles Times. No one to this day knows the identity of him. Towards his last days, Ruben was telling his colleagues and friends, hey, I think I'm being followed. I think I'm being tailed by the LAPD because you want to talk about prophecy. He was talking about police brutality in the Latino community in 1970. And so to this day, there are people who still say Ruben Salazar was targeted, if not flat out assassinated. There was a coroner's inquest done just about a week after his killing that found at best, it was a tragic, horrible accident. And the LA Sheriff's Department at the time said, yeah, our guy wasn't following his training, which nevertheless, this guy who didn't follow training and killed this iconic reporter faced no discipline and, you know, and still lives to this day.
You know, you referenced his column also, Who is a Chicano and What is It the Chicanos Want? And I just want to read a little bit from it just because I do think it gives you a real sense of Salazar. He writes, Mexican Americans, though indigenous to the Southwest, are on the lowest rung scholastically, economically, socially, and politically. Chicanos feel cheated. They want to affect change. Now Mexican Americans have to live with the stinging fact that the word Mexican is a synonym for inferior in many parts of the Southwest. That is why Mexican American activists flaunt the barrio word Chicano as an act of defiance and a badge of honor. Gustavo Arellano, what does his writing mean to you? I mean, initially, you weren't super taken with his work, as I understand.
Oh, no. Like, there's a great collection of his work called Border Correspondent, released by the University of California Press, and it takes the totality of his career. So I first came upon his work as a college student, even before I wanted to be a reporter. So I was looking for a radical. And you read a lot of his stuff, let's be honest, he wasn't the greatest of writers. And so, so looking for this radical, I'm like, this is it. I mean, his initial column is amazing, but the rest is like, you have some hits and misses, definitely not the person I thought he was going to be. So I gave the book away. Now, a little bit wiser, 20 years later, I see that the strength of Ruben was, again, I call him like a journalistic John the Baptist when it came to issues of Mexican-American, both representation in the newsroom and in the pages of the paper. So he created a beat out of nothing. You see some of his writings, both columns and reporting. He's writing about stuff we still talk about to this day. He was writing about gentrification in Mexican-American communities 55 years ago, police brutality, educational attainment, the question of immigration, the question of very much of identity. So reading him 20 years ago, I thought, oh, he was like, he's cliched. He's writing about the stuff that everyone's writing about, but I didn't realize he was the first person to do so.
We're talking with Gustavo Arellano, a columnist for the LA Times, and Daniel Hernandez, a reporter covering Los Angeles culture for the LA Times. We're talking about the Chicano moratorium in 1970, and I want to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. What are your memories of that day? What are your questions about the moratorium and its legacy? Do you remember Ruben Salazar's columns? Did they have any impact on you? And do you see parallels to what happened 50 years ago and what's happening today? Join us. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. At KQED Forum on Twitter and Facebook. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the 50-year anniversary of the National Chicano Moratorium Against the Vietnam War and the protest's legacy. We're joined by Daniel Hernandez, a reporter covering LA culture for the LA Times, and Gustavo Arellano, a columnist for the LA Times. And you, our listeners, join us. What are your questions, comments, thoughts, memories? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm joined now by Consuelo Flores, who participated in the protest at age 9. Welcome to Forum, Consuelo Flores.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Well, thank you. You were just 9 years old, but you have very vivid memories of that day, I understand. What do you remember?
As I mentioned to Daniel when he interviewed me a couple weeks ago, I was 9 years old, and I was the last of 10 kids. Seven of the brothers and sisters were going to march that day. Two of those brothers were leaders in the march. They had been organizing as part of the movement because one of my oldest brothers had gone to Vietnam. And even though he had returned, a lot of the neighbors in our little community had had a lot of brothers and sons come back either more wounded or in body bags. And so there was an understanding that there was a large imbalance and inequity in how many soldiers who were minority were coming back either severely wounded or in body bags. And my I as a child, I did not know exactly what the significance of the march was at the time. What I did know was that it was an important thing and that it was going to help in some way that brother. And so what I was very excited. It was sort of like a special event, and there was an opportunity for me to participate with my whole family, which I was very excited about. And I knew that it was an important thing. And so I wanted something to, I wanted to wear something special for that day. So that same brother who had gone to war had given me a pair of red shoes, a red tennis shoes. And so I wore them. And the night before, it was very exciting for me. I went to bed early. I was so excited the next day. I got up early. It was sort of like a Christmas and birthday, but it was different. So I hurried up. I tried to do everything quickly that day with the idea that if I did it quickly, the time would pass quickly. And we were all of my sisters and one of the younger brothers were all on the porch of my mom and dad's home in East Los Angeles. And we could hear the march, and we could hear as it was coming up the street on its on the way to Laguna Park. At the time was Laguna Park. And that's where we had gone swimming. That's where the plunge was. That's where I learned to swim. So my mom was like, yeah, sure, go and just be careful. And
well, I think you're really capturing the joyous moment and the anticipation of what that day would be, Consuelo. And I love your detail about wanting to wear those special shoes that your brother had given you. What happened to those shoes? Well, why don't you still have them today?
And this is where I start to kind of get emotional. So I think it's just PTSD. I think that really impacted my life so much. And even talking about it 50 years later is really, it gets me. So I went to the march, and I was wearing my red shoes, and we got to the park, and everything was great. Everything was wonderful. There were, you know, speakers, and there were a bunch of people, and there were, you know, I was interested in folklorical dancing, so I made sure I sat right in front of the stage where the folklorical dances were going to be performing. And so I went ahead and sat down with my sisters. My oldest sister was sitting between me and the next oldest to me on her right. I was on my oldest sister's left. And so we're sitting there, and the folklorical dancers started, and I was very excited. And suddenly somebody ran up to the stage and started yelling, "Everybody get out of the park now. Everyone get out of the park now." And suddenly again, I felt the ground beneath me shaking, and I didn't know what was going on. And as I'm trying to turn around to look at what was happening behind me, I could see bottles and smoke and rocks. And I could all of a sudden was getting lifted by my right arm. And I had taken off my shoes at that point to see the folklorico dancers after the march. And I did not have enough time to tie those shoes on. So I just slipped them in as quickly as possible. And I started running. And my sister is like, we got to run. We got to run. In the chaos of that moment, we lost all of our other siblings. So it was just the three of us. And we ran to the end of the park. And we were standing on a corner, and I was trying to get my shoes back on correctly, like tie them. And at the same time, I saw a policeman hit a man over the head with a baton, and blood just started streaming down his face. And my sister said, let's go. We've got to run. So we started running. We went back up to Whittier Boulevard, and we started running home. And at this point, I'm trying desperately not to lose my shoes, but I'm just running, and the cops are shooting at us. They're shooting tear gas at us, and my nose is burning, my lungs are burning, and my eyes were crying at this point. And suddenly, I just lost the shoes. I started running barefoot on, you know, hot August asphalt.
I can see why this event would bring up such emotions for you. I mean, what you're describing is traumatic, and also to experience it as a 9-year-old. You know, before I let you go, I wonder what you feel like you learned that day. You lost your shoes, but I almost feel like you're talking about losing something else as well, almost like a sense
so
of, yeah.
We got home, and my sister was lost. So one of my sisters was lost, and my brothers had to go find her, and they did find her, and they brought her home. She was overcome by tear gas, and she was vomiting at that point. It was a very traumatic experience. And then later on that night, we saw what was referred to at that point as the riots. And, you know, it wasn't a riot at all. And a couple of days later, we went down Whittier Boulevard to the park to survey the damage that had occurred during that, you know, the police brutality that they had inflicted on our community. And I, on the way back home, I saw my red shoes. They were against the curb on Whittier Boulevard, and I had taken such care of them, and they were completely battered. They were dirty. And I realized I could never get them. I was not ever going to be able to get them back. And years later, I realized that was, in essence, when I lost my innocence, when I really understood how our community was viewed and how disposable we were to those people who were in charge. And I also vowed at that point, without really being able to verbalize it, I vowed that I would do everything I could in my lifetime to ensure that that never happened to anybody else again, that there was going to be some kind of justice. And I have worked for social justice issues all of my life. And that is basically how those red shoes came to symbolize what my job's, my life's goal was going to be, my life's focus.
Consuelo, thank you for sharing that story. I really appreciate it. And I'm sorry that we've asked you to remember something that is clearly so difficult, but at the same time, it is amazing the kind of impact it had on you and the way that it impacted your career. Consuelo Flores joining us just now. And Daniel Hernandez, I mean, that really is a big part of this story, right? Isn't just what happened at the protest itself, but the way that it affected people, and in many ways, many Mexican-Americans afterwards. Can you talk a little bit about what you learned in terms of its legacy or its impact?
Yeah, well, as Consuelo's story and as her moving account of what happened that day, I think, demonstrates, the emotions remain really very raw and real and very current and fresh, I guess, in terms of how that event impacted the promise of what this kind of cultural renaissance and political awakening that was occurring in that era, which is something that most of us today only read about or hear about or see in the documentary films and read about in the stories that we try to produce. But, you know, thankfully we still have people who are there who can help us understand, you know, both how deeply it impacted, but the community at large, but also sort of how kind of normal these kinds of confrontations in many ways would go on to become. And even still to this day, I mean, there are protests that are Latino-led in Los Angeles about unarmed Latino men who were killed by sheriffs or the LAPD to this day. And so I think that it is important to remember, though, that ultimately what occurred that day really affected each person on an individual level and in different ways.
Well, let me go to caller Michael in Oakland. Hi, Michael. Join us.
Hi. Thank you very much. You know, I'm one of the probably many non-Latinos who was there at that march. I'm so glad that they're, you know, bringing this back into the consciousness, because I thought it had been forgotten to history. I was a young teacher. I had just come back from the Peace Corps in Borneo. My first job was teaching adults in East Los Angeles in a federal program. And so I had made very close friends, and I had one particular family that basically adopted me. I was part of their family, and we were all at this wonderful occasion protesting the war, but protesting it with music and dance and laughter and families and picnics. And it was just, it was really a wonderful, memorable event until what's been described began. And police came charging into this group of peaceful people sitting on the grass, enjoying themselves. Tear gas began wafting over everything. I remember my friends, my family lived about one block from the park. So we ran back and forth and back and forth, taking mostly children, but also older people who had been affected by the tear gas into our home, into their home, and, you know, washed their faces and maybe fed them. And so the house grew larger and larger in terms of the people getting away from the devastation. And across the street from the house that I that they lived in, where I was then a guest, was a fire station. There was a police car in front of the fire station, which had been overturned and set on fire. And so there was a cop guarding that fire station. And that road that they lived on led from Whittier Boulevard onto the freeway. And a man, an older man, was driving down toward the freeway entrance, and he looked absolutely terrified. And the cop across the street leveled his gun and said a couple of times, "Halt, halt," and then shot him. And he then, his car smashed into a telephone pole and the wire came down. And the next day, the newspaper reported that he had been electrocuted. In fact, he had been shot before he was electrocuted. Mm-hmm. And I also remember walking down with my friend to get my car afterwards, which is several miles down Whittier Boulevard. And at every intersection, at every corner, there were armed police. And my friend and I, these are adults now, this is an adult, Chicano, and I had to stop, raise our hands, sort of be given the go-ahead to cross the street. And we did that block after block after block. And then my family moved in with me for one night into my home, which was a place called Monterey Park, a little bit east of East L.A. But anyway, it is an absolutely firm and clear memory in my head, and I've been sort of waiting for someone to remember this not just event, but this feeling that was that encapsulated the whole community. And later on, just a little postscript, when I got very deeply involved in criminal reform, I was at a prison conference, and my little roommate in my hotel where we had the conference was a Chicano man who had come back from Vietnam, and he described his memory of Vietnam as a quotation, as a sound memory, which was, "Gonzalez, take the point." And the point is where one man walks in front of everyone else, to either find mines, often by triggering them and killing them or losing their legs, or drawing fire. So only one person gets it. So, but his memory was Gonzalez, take the point. So that was a job often reserved for Latinos and African-American soldiers.
Michael, thanks for sharing those memories. And also, really, you are underscoring what has been brought up already, which is just the incredible impact that this protest, that this moratorium had on so many people's lives. Let me go to Ray in Santa Barbara next. Hi, Ray. Join us.
Hello?
Hi, Ray. You're on.
Okay. I was not there. But my brothers, my two brothers and my cousin, at least one cousin, I have many cousins, they were there. My cousin Bobby was really beaten badly. And I had to work at Jack in the Box in Santa Ana, Orange County, to put myself through college, so I couldn't go. But I think the thing that I took out of it the most was the death of Ruben Salazar. Because I've been a journalist all my life, about 45 years. And I think a lot of other people like me, maybe thousands, were inspired by what he was trying to do. And you should remember, he was not a liberal, you know, raving, you know, Chicano activist. And he was very conservative. He lived in Orange County like I did. And He really represented the type of thing that I think California and the whole country needed more was more writings about Chicanos. And today people don't use that term that often, but I always will.
Because,
I'm a journalist
yeah.
who happens to be a Chicano. And I urge everyone to read the LA Times articles by Robert Lopez, I believe it came out this week, about Salazar and about the moratorium in general, because it says a lot. And in fact, the lady who lost her shoes is mentioned there in that article. But Robert wrote, Robert's a great journalist too, along with my friend George Ramos.
Well, thank you, Ray, for sharing that. And we have a listener who right. Sonoma State University named its library Salazar Hall in the 1970s. Now I know why. We're remembering the 50th anniversary. Well, remembering the National Chicano Moratorium against the Vietnam War 50 years later, and we're hearing its impact and legacy. And we'll have more of that after the break. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the 50-year anniversary of the National Chicano Moratorium against the Vietnam War and the protests' legacy. We're joined by Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, Daniel Hernandez, a reporter covering Los Angeles culture for the LA Times, and with you, our listeners, 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786 is the number to call about questions you have, comments, memories, also parallels you might see to this day. You can also reach us on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. As I'm listening to these recollections, Gustavo Arellano, one of the things that I'm struck by is what is written as part of this project, that it fueled an urgency to make visible the Chicano experience. I was especially struck by Ray saying that, you know, not a lot of people use that term anymore, but he chooses to use it. I mean, do you have any thoughts on, you know, that urgency and where that urgency is today?
The urgency continues, except the young radicals, progressives, they no longer, very few of them call themselves Chicano anymore. They call themselves Latinx. And that's perfectly fine. You know, and it's interesting how history keeps repeating itself. But the one constant remains you have a group, Mexican-Americans, who battle and try and do achieve stuff, but yet they still realize that the system is stacked against them. They realize that people still think of them in all sorts of horrible terms in many ways, going back to the 1850s here in California. And so something needs to be done about that. I'm the child of Mexican immigrants. I never thought of myself as a Chicano until very, very recently. And for me, the term Chicano, it connects me to the activists of the past and allows me to look forward into what we're all trying to do, no matter what you call yourself, which is better the situation in your community and better yourself.
Why did that term start to resonate with you more?
Just in reading, learning more about the history and seeing people now trying to castigate that term as somehow problematic and macho and homophobic and anti-Black, all stuff that flies in the face of the historical reality. So one of the previous callers, the teacher who said, like, I was one of the many people who were not Chicano who were there at the moratorium. There's this great photo of a young Black man marching hand in hand with his fellow Chicanos during the famous Chicano student walkouts of 1968. You also had African-American students walking out in solidarity with their Chicano classmates and also to address their own issues as well. So for me, the term Chicano is really a political sense. Anyone can be a Chicano. You just have to be ready to, you know, fight for el movimiento.
I also read that there were Japanese Americans who had been incarcerated during World War II who were there as well. You know, Danielle Hernandez, why did the moratorium committee disband? It's written almost as though sort of the movement maybe lost some momentum after this event.
That's a very good question. I think that after the kind of violence and shock of what occurred, that there was different reactions, right? And some people sort of retreated entirely from activism. Gloria Arellanes was one of the key figures early in the Brown Berets, for example. She really began looking inward. And as one of the stories in the LA Times package by Vanessa Martinez and Julia Barajas sort of explores how she decided to really explore her indigenous heritage. And she became an official member of a Tongva tribal group there in the Los Angeles area. Other people sort of stuck with the hard kind of activist mentality. But it's true. By the end of the following year, by the following August, the moratorium, I think, had suffered a lot of internal divisions. There was fear of infiltration, and infiltration actually by federal agents and by spies, basically, who would attempt to kind of sow division. And ultimately, the historical theory is that they were successful. And by August of 1971, the original moratorium committee disbanded.
Well, we're joined now by Carmen Ramirez, who participated in the protest as a college student and is now a member of Oxnard City Council. Welcome to Forum, Carmen Ramirez.
Good morning. Thank you for this. And it's always great to be interviewed by essential workers, the journalists of today.
Well, thanks for saying that. I wonder if you could tell me, as a college student, why you were drawn to the protest, why you wanted to make sure you were there.
Well, I was involved with MECHA, which was the Chicano student group at Cal State LA. And I knew many people, including my brothers, who were potentially going to be drafted. I had graduated from high school in Pico Rivera in 1966, and immediately following graduation, many of my classmates immediately went to Vietnam, and not everybody came home. And also, we were seeing the disparity in the death rate, the casualty rate, and the fact that many people, the Latino community, could not get into college. Didn't have the ability to get a deferment. We know now that who got the deferments, including someone in the White House who got deferments, and before him, many other people. But in our community, it was difficult to get them because we didn't have access to higher education as much as we would have wished. So that was the issue, I think. And the Chicano moratorium, I believe, started out as the spur for it was the blowouts of East LA, where students in our East LA high schools walked out a couple of years before complaining about lack of quality education, what it meant for their futures. And I think that may have been the start of the activism of many people.
Yes. And as Daniel and others pointed out, some of the simmering tensions that that were existing when the moratorium occurred. Do you see a through line, Carmen Ramirez, between the career path you chose, the public service? I understand that you focus on environmental issues. Do you see a through line to that and the moratorium, from the moratorium to that?
Well, for me, it's been environmental justice issues. And I was in college, you know, I really was interested in being a lawyer, but for me, it wasn't just a dream, it was a fantasy. But because of opportunities that opened up, I was able to go to Loyola Law School, became a lawyer, and was a legal aid attorney for more than 20 years, and now I'm on city council here in Oxnard. But the through line is the quest for justice and equality, which we're seeing in today's movements of social unrest, demands for justice in the Black Lives Movement. I'm very proud of our city council because we did unanimously adopt a resolution calling racism a public health crisis. And we did declare that Black Lives Matter. So I see the through line, and, you know, just as Martin Luther King said, you know, it's a long way, but we are going towards justice. We have to keep fighting for it. And those of us who think, well, you could get it in a day, or, you know, I'm done, I already did my 5 years of being an activist. You know, it's till the day you leave the planet.
Well, yeah. Carmen Ramirez, thanks so much for your reflections. Really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank
Carmen
you.
Carmen Ramirez, a member of the Oxnard City Council who was at the National Chicano Moratorium against the Vietnam War. And let me go to Kiara in Corte Madera. Hi, Kiara. Hi, Kiara. Are you with us?
Hi there. Sorry, I was on mute.
No problem.
Hi. I really appreciate this program. I'm very, very interested. I identify as a young Chicana. I'm in my early 20s and have been coming into that identity within the past couple of years. And in just reflecting on my parents' generation and then my grandparents' generation, who were very involved with, like, the farm workers' strikes, I'm just looking at the present state of, like, the protests that are happening around me for my generation of Chicanos and Chicanas, and in reflecting on this era in the 70s, it feels like it was such a robust and powerful movement, and I think that I've been searching for that in the present a bit and trying to understand what happened to it. And I understand the questions that were just answered really do speak to that, of how it transformed and kind of disseminated. But just, it is kind of a then and now question of, like, where do you see it now? Do you think there is the power to recoalesce into the strength of what the Chicano movement was then? How to bring back that organizing power for this new generation that didn't get to be there, but is existing within this current Black Lives Matter moment?
Kiara, thanks. Gustavo Arellano, your thoughts?
I think it's happening, actually, triggered by Black Lives Matter, and also, though, by this younger generation of whatever you want to call yourselves, is perfectly fine, Latinx, Chicanos, or whatever, but they're looking at this history. I cannot overstate how, not just well-received, but embraced this project that the LA Times did. A lot of people saying, I didn't know this history. A lot of people saying, I read about it a little bit, but not in that detail. And so people are being inspired by by the folks from the past, by the pioneers, and real pioneers, by the way, into going into the present day. But as always, let's also not romanticize the Chicano movement. A lot of the reason the Chicano movement also just petered out was because there was a lot of infighting. There was a lot of internecine warfare going on, which our package also gets into. So my hope is that this younger generation, as all younger generations should, learn from the past, get the good, keep the bad in the past, and move and, you know, forge a better path forward for all of us.
I may be wrong, but my sense from reading what career paths and decisions that people made, Daniel Hernandez, after this event, there was almost also this attempt to try to reform as opposed to revolutionize the system. Go ahead.
There was I also spoke in the piece to Gloria Molina. Gloria Molina, of course, was one of the earliest Latinas elected to the California Assembly. She's kind of a titan in kind of California Mexican American politics, she actually was hesitant at first to join the moratorium because she didn't want to be marching behind, get this, Mexican flags or flags of Mexico. She was a fully sort of assimilated in many ways Mexican-American, and she had had a unpleasant experience traveling to Mexico basically as a tourist with Mexican immigration authorities. So that kind of colored her view of the kind of middle of the road, let's say, kind of viewpoint that she's always sort of maintained. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that a lot of people chose to enter the institutions, people like Molina and others, and in different ways, of course, educational institutions, corporate institutions, and otherwise. And so I think that there really was a range of perspectives and ideologies that were represented there, which again, I think goes back to how important that event really was.
Well, let me go to Sylvia in Thousand Oaks. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. Thank you.
Please go right ahead.
Yeah, I was at the moratorium. My uncle, who had served in the Korean War, he had come home, and I would always, I didn't live in the East LA. I lived in the San Gabriel Valley, and I would visit my family there. And he, when he just said, come on, and he grabbed a bunch of us kids, and I'm not sure how many of my cousins, we all went, we were walking down Whittier Boulevard in the moratorium, and I didn't see any of the violence because I think that maybe it happened and then we left, I'm guessing. But I know later on in years, I found out that my other uncle was on stage at this. He was a, I guess, an activist of some sort in the, but, you know, so, and I was, I wish I had time to call my cousins to say, okay, you know, give me some more information to kind of put it together. But I remember we were walking down and it was just fun. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. And being with my uncle, which we all just, he was the oldest, we just loved him. And so it was a great event being with my cousins. We were walking down the street and everyone was joyous. And thank God I didn't see the violence because I think that would have been awful, that poor girl, which she went through. And so,
yeah. Sorry, Sylvia, was there something else you wanted to say?
Well, someone made reference about education and not in being, my dad went to Roosevelt High School. And when he went to Roosevelt, he, his junior high counselor said to him, or brought him to the school and said, this is a college preparatory young man. Please give him, you know, get him some classes. And they wouldn't give him anything college prep. They gave him all the wood shop, metal shop classes. Mm. And he went in, and I remember him asking, my dad told me, he said, I went and said, please just give me one typing class. And they wouldn't give it to him.
Wow, Sylvia, that's quite a story. Thank you for sharing your recollections of that day. And also that story, just really illuminating some of the larger things people were fighting for and the experiences that they had. Let me see if I can squeeze one last call in from Ron in Santa Rosa. Hi, Ron.
Hi, my name is Ron Lopez. I'm a professor of Chicano Latino Studies at Sonoma State University. I was too young, or I would have been only about 6 years old during the moratorium, but it left a lasting impact on me and many of my peers. I know that one of the things that's come up is the divisions and also the efforts to divide. And even today, people arguing about, you know, like, what are we going to call ourselves? And I think those are all things that everybody should be allowed to call themselves what they like. What really matters is that we work together on issues of common purpose, like social justice, educational rights. I mean, all these kids that are denied educational opportunities, you know, that's really wrong, but that's still happening. So in our communities, everybody listening can play a role in making things better. And
well, Ron,
it behooves all of us to do so.
Ron, thank you for that reflection. Lauren writes, I was a college student at Cal State Los Angeles and attended the protest with a Chicano friend of mine. The two of us were in the park when suddenly a sharp noise echoed through the park. We walked to my friend's house and climbed on the roof. Then we saw a huge plume of smoke and heard cheers from blocks away at the Goodyear tire plant, known to be racist against Latinos, was burning. One of the things that we haven't actually talked about that I do just want to touch on with the couple minutes that we have left is just the impact that this event had on the arts. And as I hear people, Gustavo Arellano, talking about wanting to learn more or see more, I'm thinking of the murals that emerged after this. Can you talk a little bit about the impact that this had on art, photography, music?
my Times colleague, Carolina Miranda, she wrote a definitive piece on this, but just really brief recap. The whole Chicano mural movement really sprouted out because of the moratorium. Legendary groups like ASCO Performance Art from the moratorium. Dia de los Muertos, which now is celebrated all across the United States, arguably started in the wake of the Chicano moratorium. Poetry, music, so much of what is now Mexican-American Latino art started because as a reaction to or reflection of the Chicano moratorium.
Yes, I love this line from Miranda's piece. It's moving what had been private into the public space.
Yeah, just a recapturing. If LA sheriff's deputies and PD were going to crack down on public spaces and, you know, kill Ruben Salazar and two other men in the process, well, now the artists were going to reclaim it for the community, and they've been reclaiming it ever since.
Is there anything, Daniel Hernandez, that you feel like surprised you or that you learned from reporting on this project or even just looking at this moment that we're in now from the lens of covering the moratorium that you could leave us with?
Yeah, I mean, I think Harry Gamboa puts it very well. He says that basically, you know, Harry Gamboa was one of the founding members of OSCO, and he was at the moratorium, and he also sort of recalls it as a moment, which, as Carmen said earlier, just on the call, that really solidified that the participants' commitment to social justice, whatever form that may take. Over the years, it's been a real concentration on police brutality, then it becomes urban renewal or what is now called gentrification. And now the more direct confrontation and struggle over police and justice reform and the effects of police violence. I mean, all of that, the movements and even the organizing principles return to that period and for the Mexican-American community return to the moratorium. So yeah, it's really interesting just to see the little connections across time. The calls, for example, even on the program today, have just been so rich and moving. So you can see that those connections keep growing.
Yeah. Well, Daniel Hernandez and Gustavo Arellano, thank you both for your work on this project. Daniel Hernandez, a reporter covering culture in LA for the LA Times, also formerly with the New York Times and a correspondent with Vice, and also Gustavo Arellano, a columnist for the LA Times as well, also with the with Ask a Mexican. Thanks, both of you. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.